Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com.
Welcome to Enterprise Linux Security, episode number 98. I've been away for a bit. I was in Nova Scotia, Canada. I actually released four videos from that event. So the first one's my personal favorite, but you know, I think these videos will be pretty cool because it wasn't just for the event. The stuff about switching to Linux, there's some helpful content that came out of that. But now that I'm finished with all that and I'm 20% caught up after being away, we're back and we're doing another episode. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As always, a pleasure. Yeah, 2 weeks away. It's another vacation. We often have these vacations. But yeah, 98 episodes. We're almost hitting that round number there. And we have some more catching up to do. There are some interesting stories that came up, and we have a broader topic that we'll be covering on the second half of the episode. But the first one is probably one that, I don't know, made the more buzz in the past couple of weeks.
It sounds like a really horrible thing at first, but there's a workaround that's extremely easy that I'll get to after.
There is another workaround, probably not the one that you're going to mention, that I will cover, that's also very easy and bypasses all of this. So I'm talking about YubiKey and uClick, and I hope I'm pronouncing this.
uClick, I think it is.
uClick.
Greek? Oh, gosh. Who's in charge of these names? Could we find out? I need to talk to that individual.
uClick. Okay, so YubiKey, the multi-factor authentication device. It's about USB pen size. You carry it with you, and you use it when you're trying to authenticate to, I don't know, secure systems that require multi-factor, and it's a pretty secure and convenient one. And we recommend it. We've talked about it in past episodes. And it turns out that, like anything else, people started prodding and people started looking for vulnerabilities. And guess what? They found one. Apparently, the devices can be cloned, which is not something you like. You're going to enjoy if your key is supposed to be unique and there's not going to be another one.
Yeah, I mean, and let's be clear here. These are not devices where you could simply install a firmware update. The firmware, my understanding, is literally baked into the chip.
That's actually one of the things that prevents this problem from being addressed on the keys that are already out there, is that the firmware cannot be upgraded. There is a secure firmware version on devices probably sold and produced after that date from early May that addresses the problem, but for the vast majority of YubiKeys out there, their firmware is vulnerable and there's no way around it. So what the problem actually is, and this is interesting, this is a side channel attack, meaning that the attacker doesn't necessarily go after the device or try to tamper with the actual functioning of the device in any way. It just looks at the data as it flows and looks at the electrical charges moving along. And apparently it's possible to infer the keys as that thing is happening, as the data is moving there, the device is initializing. So it's possible to read the information in it, take that data, and then write it to a different key, and you'll have a clone of that device. Now, why isn't the sky actually falling with all of this? Because you need to remember that these devices are used in very sensitive situations, probably to see, and this is something else, probably to secure the top secret information, top secret access, all of that level of confidentiality. So in the places where you actually are required to use this type of devices, it's probably where it will hurt the most. But the reason why the sky isn't actually falling is that to get access to the specific pins inside of the device that you need to access to read the data, you actually need to open the device. If you've ever held one in your hand,
yes, they're really tiny.
They're small, and the plastic around, the casing around it, it's actually molded. It's kind of melded around on the seam, so it's not something that you can pry open and then close back up again. When you open it, it's noticeable that somebody opened it. So if somebody takes away your key, it goes through this process of cloning it. When it puts it back into your pocket or wherever you store it, it will be noticeable to the user that the key has been tampered with physically. And that's why the sky isn't falling. It's not like you go to a bar at night, somebody gets a handle of this and clones it and then gives it back to you and you don't notice it. No, you will notice that the device has been tampered with. It's pretty visible. The sticking point here is that YubiKeys are not the only devices where this type of chips are being used. These are Infineon chips. They are used on everything from TPM chips in motherboards to identity cards to passports to other type of devices. And while the people who identify this flaw didn't test other devices, it's very likely that they will also be vulnerable to this. So keep an eye out on this story. There might be more to it.
And immediately, this is going to be a cost for some enterprises out there, even if they don't feel that it's the biggest issue in the world. We'll get to that in a minute. We actually are kind of already talked about that anyway. The policy might be that they just need to be replaced. One of the articles mentioned that maybe YubiKey will offer the larger enterprises discounts or something like that. I don't really know. But, you know, there's a cost associated with that, and there's also a time cost associated with that, and especially in the enterprise when if all, you know, a subset of your employees, a large subset of your employees have to re-authenticate with a brand new key, then that ties up your support for a little while. So it can be, and it's something that's going to impact people regardless of whether or not we feel that the means of attack is something that could happen anyway, likely.
Another thing that you need to keep in mind is that this is just one of the authentication factors. You still need the username and password to make an attack that that abuses this. And as one author puts it, at that point, you might as well bring out the crowbar and not for the device. So, yeah.
And the workaround is simply this. If someone asks to, you know, get a hold of your YubiKey, wants to check it out or take a look at it, just say no. That's it. And make sure your passwords don't leak. I mean, at this point, it's sometimes I wonder if some of these stories are just sensationalizing some of these things just for the sake of sensationalizing them. Yes, there's an impact. Yes, it's going to be a policy that enterprises will probably have to buy some replacements. But if someone takes advantage of this vulnerability, then I have bigger questions and they all start with the user.
There might be a bit more to it than that, at least from my point of view. In the places where you need the highest clearance and confidentiality requirements, which are also the places where this is more necessary, you could imagine that a threat actor with sufficient resources, and I do mean state-sponsored at this point, is going to go the extra mile to access, clone, and return the YubiKey. And they might have access to tools that let them simply mold another casing around it so that it will not be noticeable. Again, this is the type of devices where, while we advise everybody to use multi-factor authentication, and this is a pretty good, it remains a pretty good multi-factor authentication factor. Apologies for the duplicate there. You can see it as being, the moment that this becomes clonable, it means that lots of the security posture that you might have around your systems and around your services that require it, it just goes through the window. Another thing interesting here is that this has been in the device for 14 years. It has gone unnoticed for 14 years. During those 14 years, YubiKeys have received dozens of security certifications. None of it found it. And those certifications were for the highest level of security users, and I'm talking defense contractors and the like. So they were doing the certifications, nobody noticed this. It does call into question what are you actually trying to achieve and what you are trying to prove when you certify a device. Is it that it actually meets all of those requirements, or does it just meet whatever things you say about it? I tell you that this is very secure and you put a stamp saying, yeah, this is really very secure, but you actually don't test anything. So, yeah.
I guess one of my big issues with this is that, you know, when they're sensationalizing something like this, meaning, you know, it's one thing if it's remote code execution and everyone's vulnerable, don't get me wrong, people are vulnerable to this. I'm not saying anyone isn't, but it just kind of takes away from the issues that I think are more likely to impact somebody. But we're going to talk about another story shortly that talks about social engineering and, you know, some of the old ways are still just as effective as they are now. But we have security keys that are going to be sensationalized, and this is my main problem, like they're bad, like you shouldn't use them now because there's this big egregious problem, and now they've been, you know, owned, so to speak, and that might make people not want to use a security key. I want to be clear, even with this vulnerability, YubiKeys are still an effective means of securing your account. They just are. I mean, you need, like, I think $11,000 worth of equipment, one article mentioned, in order to, you know, effectively, you know, take advantage of this vulnerability. Now, obviously, things get easier over time, never harder. But we definitely want to make sure people understand you should definitely still be using two-factor authentication. That should not stop, not even with news like this.
I mean, two-factor authentication lets you avoid one of the most common attack vectors, which is just password spraying. So it remains a good choice. It remains much better than simple password alone. And you should actually implement multi-factor authentication if you haven't. That's just one way of improving your security posture. It's regrettable that the keys have been found to be vulnerable to this, have been found to be clonable. The new ones that you will buy right now, if you're going to go down this route, they are no longer vulnerable. They will have the newest firmware available. Actually, make sure that the firmware that you're acquiring is after May. So if it is, you can rest assured that, as far as we know, with the information available right now, those are secure. And actually, the way that those are secure is that they simply bypass that function that can be monitored, and they deployed new software to do that into the device itself, so it will not happen the same way as before. That will no longer be observable, and you have a different way of achieving the same thing. Again, still a good choice if you're looking to improve your posture. If you don't have multi-factor authentication, this is a good step in that direction, even with this news.
So basically, if you have an impacted security key and you care, you can replace the security key, but you could also continue using the one you have. It's just that throwing away your security key is not the message we're sending here. So I think that'll make that clear for our listeners.
Okay, moving on. So there are three... There was the Verizon's data breach investigation report that we covered a few episodes back about data breaches that occurred last year. One of the main takeaways on that report was that the three major attack vectors that were used last year, and they covered over 10,000 incidents, were, in this order, phishing, email phishing, password spraying, and vulnerabilities being exploited. So one of the stories that made the rounds the past couple of weeks is... It's actually a marketing blog post. And the reason that I say this is a marketing blog post is that I should know I've written quite a few. it's part of my job description. And the way that you can spot a marketing blog post is that it starts by describing a problem, and then they tell you how their product solves that problem. That's how they are all written. Mea culpa, I've written them myself like that. That's just how it goes. But the main takeaway on those articles is that they're not false. Okay, you cannot write one of those articles with false information, or you would be called out on it, and whatever you're trying to push would immediately be thrown under the rug. So the articles are not false per se. They have an intent, which is to get you to acquire their product or to look at that problem and see, oh, I'm also affected by it. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. So that's the goal of this type of marketing articles. And one interesting one that I noticed was that phishing is still, as obviously by the previous report confirms that, it's still a really important thing. And one of the reasons why phishing is still that important and is still not a solved problem is that most email servers out there will simply scan the emails and try to look for specific signatures for malware. Actually, not for malware, but for phishing emails. And that in itself is not the correct approach. As antivirus vendors have discovered decades ago, if you just go for a rules-based approach, as soon as the virus changes slightly, and in this case the phishing emails changes slightly, a single sentence, a single word, it's enough for the rule to fail. So the emails will no longer get flagged and the user will receive them. Rules-based security is never a good choice, especially in the environment that we are in today. It's just not flexible enough, and one of the main reasons why phishing is just the problem that it is precisely because that's how we're trying to solve it.
We have to understand that when we buy a security appliance, I just want to get this part out there, it's, you know, just like you said, I could spot that a mile away. But I think for me, it was when they used the acronym SEGs, which there's nothing wrong with that, but, you know, the way that it's written, but I digress. When you add a device like that or any other secure email gateway, whatever it is, you're adding additional security. You're going to get fewer security issues by some number. And the threat actors aren't sitting on their hands saying, oh, they have a secure email gateway, so I'm just not going to do anything now. I mean, some might that aren't very skilled, but most, like you said, they're just going to utilize social engineering attacks. And I think one of the issues is people will have a product like this and just have a false sense of security, and then they just get relaxed. And I think that's just not the way they should be.
And one of the reasons why virus vendors got away from signature-based detection is because, again, like I said, it's really easy to avoid. The reason why it's tricky to get away from it, it's because if you don't use a rules-based system, you need a heuristic system, meaning that you're not going to detect by a set of signatures that you know. You're going to detect by a set of rules that should be broad enough to capture even slight variations of what you're trying to detect. And the problem with that is that it's very easy to get false positives. And if the CEO emails start being flagged as phishing emails and they stop being received by whoever he's sending them to, then that's a problem. And unfortunately, that's a problem for whoever is managing the email gateway, which in turn turns out to be sysadmins. There's a lack of incentive there to be very stringent, because when you tighten those rules, then you'll start flagging the wrong emails. No, go ahead. I can rant about antivirus in a moment.
Well, I just wanted to point out that I'm just looking it up to make sure I'm telling you the truth. Episode 65 of our podcast, we talked about open source intelligence. And it's mentioned right in the article that we linked to, where they even bring up open source intelligence, because that's what's used to power, you know, a lot of this. I mean, your phishing emails, I mean, if they could find out anything specific about the CEO, that's, you know, open source intelligence. It's freely available information that can then be used to craft an email to take someone over. And the article points out that, you know, the signature-based methods aren't really going to do a good job detecting this, because, you know, that's going to look very official. They're going to take their time on that email to make sure that it gets out there. That's the goal. So this gateway, you know, enterprises need to understand this. It's going to cut the script kiddies out of the equation, the, you know, beginner threat actors out of the equation, or the, you know, bots or whatever. But when it becomes targeted, that's when everything starts to fall over.
When the attackers start to use techniques like obfuscation, where they don't necessarily use the exact phrasing that you would expect, when they start calling things by slightly different names, so that if you're reading it, you don't get the change, and you also get the right meaning that they want you to, but the actual words are not written there. If you change characters for their UTF lookalikes, those kinds of things, it's all ways that you can avoid this type of rules. You mentioned the social engineering part, getting the information from freely available from freely available stuff online. Something else that's also touches on antivirus, it's the polymorphic emails. What that means is that the emails won't always be the same. phishing is usually just thrown out to as many targets as possible, and you just want one person or a few person to click that link or to access that website that is in the email. You don't actually need everybody to do it. Rather than sending the same exact email to everybody, you'll make slight variations to the content so that each person gets an individual different email. It's going to be slightly different for everybody so that it avoids the rules, or if the rules just catch one or two, the others will still be received.
And there's lookalike domains too. I mean, I just want to make sure I bring that up, because that's really hard to detect, because I think that's a really great example of how easy threat actors just literally walk around these problems. Like, you'll have a system that will check the registrar records, you know, make sure it's a valid domain, has a valid certificate and all of that. But if a domain is, you know, found to be bad, I mean, it literally takes them as long as it takes DNS to propagate, because they just buy another domain. So all of that technology to verify, you know, sources, and the threat actors, they all just get another domain and use Let's Encrypt or something else to verify it. And they don't care if it gets knocked down or it gets detected an hour later, because they probably have 20 more of them out that are already being registered. And lookalike domains will, you know, be something like go0gle.com instead of google.com or something like that. And you know, we know when we see that one of the O's is bigger than the other that there's a red flag there. But, you know, your average person, you know, they don't really look as closely, and they're likely to click on it. It's got the HTTPS. It's got the padlock or whatever they're doing now. It looks like a secure domain. It is a secure domain because the registrar or the threat actor bought the domain and made sure that it had a legit certificate. And it really does look to the average person like it's totally fine. And even then, they could just simply have a simple link that has it spelled correctly, but the link underneath it is going to the wrong one. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but I think that's why this is so hard, because the threat actors they're not really put off by any of this.
And the really insidious ones are the ones that don't even have a link and don't even have a payload on the email. It's just an actual English text email that says, hey, I really need your information. Go to my company's website and fill in that data. When that comes from a compromised account at a legitimate company that you're doing business with, that you're familiar with the person, and somehow that person got the account compromised, then you're going to trust that email, and it's phishing, and you're going to follow the instructions, and you're likely going to go into a compromised website as well. That's how deep the rabbit hole goes here. Yeah, and the actual techniques that we have to try to address some of the problems with email spam and email phishing are SPF, are DKIM, DMARC, but all of those are based off of DNS. If you use a domain lookalike, then you own that domain, so you can configure all of those tools correctly for that lookalike domain, and they will function properly, and they will say that the email is perfectly valid and passes all the security and all the signatures checkout. So yeah, I really don't see a foolproof solution to address phishing anytime soon. We're going to continue to be hit by this. And this actually ties into the last topic that I would like to bring up today, which is, what's the limiting factor for your infrastructure?
I love this topic. I love this a lot.
The immediate answer might be, well, stupid, it's the amount of money that you can spend on it. You purchase more servers if you have the money for it, so your infrastructure keeps growing. That's how it's limited. And there's actually much, much more to that. It's not just how much money you can throw at a problem. It's much more complex than that.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, even in HomeLab, we talk about limits where we have people in their basement, creating more servers than they could possibly ever maintain. But, you know, while I'm joking, in reality, it's not funny when that same thing is happening in an enterprise, and then you have more servers than you know what to do with. I mean, then there's, as we're going to talk about, there's some additional challenges that not a lot of people think about, because AWS is advertising, you know, you can have a server, you can have a server, everybody gets a server, you can have 100 servers, auto scaling, auto healing, it's all good. You can have 10,000 and it's fine, pay us money.
It's more or less like that. And we've actually automated part of that, and that's probably why we believe we can do that. We automated the deployment, we automated the teardown, we've automated even the monitoring aspect of it. So the single sysadmin that could take care of, I don't know, 50 servers previously can now manage 500 servers and feel confident about it. But the actual limiting factor there, it's not how many servers you can bring up, it's not how many servers you can tear down, it's how many servers you can maintain securely. That's the defining factor for how large your infrastructure can grow. Because of all of the tasks around the server lifecycle, all of the things that you need to do to a server to keep it running properly, to make sure that it's not just deployed and taken down after the end of its lifecycle, you need to deploy patches to it. And the tricky thing with deploying patches to a server is that it's not immediately automatable like all the other tasks are. Because applying patches, traditionally, is something that's very disruptive. You need to interrupt the workload, you need to do reboots, and it stops whatever it is you're doing. So you can't just automate it blindly and expect it to work. And then the limiting factor, the amount of systems that you can maintain, that you can update, is defined by the amount of time that you have in a given cycle. If you take 1 month to update all of your systems and then you start over again, if you add more servers there, the time doesn't grow. You still only have 1 month to do all of that. If it doesn't fit, it boils over, and then you're going to have extra work on the next cycle and you're going to miss more systems, and it just adds up. So at some point, there is this hard limit, and it's really a hard limit, because it doesn't mean that you can't just simply add more people, add more money, and expect more things to fit into that allotted time. Because one patch is going to take X amount of time to deploy, and it's going to take X amount of time to reboot, regardless of how much money you throw at the problem. That's not something you can buy your way out of.
And one thing that's not really discussed a lot is that automation is not 100% foolproof. Now, I know that goes against the little, you know, the actual reason why you want to automate in the first place. I mean, at most you can hope for 99%, because there's always going to be something. There's always a one-off. I remember one time a change in Ubuntu in the repositories that I had nothing to do with caused my automation system to fail on everything. But even when it doesn't egregiously fail, I only have, you know, probably a couple dozen servers that I'm, you know, keeping an eye on, that I maintain and are responsible for. And they're fully automated, but I still check them regularly. And every now and then I find something stuck. I find something didn't copy correctly. So we sell automation like it's going to literally automate everything. And yes, it does, but it needs auditing. It needs to be looked at. And the more servers you're automating, the more servers you're auditing. And I think that's something that a lot of people aren't thinking about.
And if you think about it, if your business relies on your IT growing and expanding, and this applies to many different fields, not just IT specifically, there are many industries that can only expand their operations if they have a powerful IT system behind them supporting those operations. So in order to grow the business, the IT becomes the limiting factor. In this specific case, the IT infrastructure becomes the limiting factor. Until you find a solution to let you grow that infrastructure securely, the business is suffering because it can't grow. This is really, really a limiting factor for the enterprise, and it goes way beyond the IT space alone. Now, this cropped up as a topic. Last week, I had a company webinar that I was presenting about live patching, and I was talking about the benefits of live patching and all of that. And almost as an afterthought, this was brought up. And we've had in the past, we at Tuxair, we had in the past some customers, and we usually talk with customers about their experience and how they're using the products and the solutions and how they're helping it and all of that. And one of the things that was brought up by a very large customer, they have tens of thousands of systems, was that live patching had become an enabler for their company to grow. I'm obviously not going to name them. They didn't give me permission to do that. But the reasoning being that they were taking those 30 days to patch all of their infrastructure when they were around 3,000 servers and they had 50 people on the team. The company was not going to continue to grow the team, the IT team, indefinitely, forever. It's not an infinite thing. You can't just keep adding people to the problem, expecting it to be manageable. The only way that they could grow past that number of servers was precisely when they brought in live patching. I'm obviously plugging live patching, definitely, but the reasoning stands that there is this hard limit on your operations, and it's not defined just by the amount of money and resources that you can throw at the problem. And this is interesting because not many problems are like that. Most problems in the enterprise space, you can solve them by simply throwing resources and money at them. You need faster time to market, get more people working on the product. You need better research, hire more researchers to do that. But this is one of the things that is not limited by money.
And have you ever noticed that IT budgets are always too little or too much and never just right?
Anyway, they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, yeah.
It might not be obvious at first glance. It might not be obvious when you're working on your infrastructure that you have deployed and you've had for years. But consider how long it takes for your patch management cycle to happen. Now consider how long you would take if you had double the number of systems. Would it still fit in the same envelope? And the answer is going to be no, absolutely not. Because you cannot shorten the turnaround on each system. So at some point, it doesn't grow. And if nothing else, then this is something that you need to pay attention to if your company experiences any type of growth, and they all try to at least. And that's a consideration that is not taken into account when you're planning budget and when you're planning your business plan for the following years. But it should. If you rely on IT as an enabler for the business, you need to account on how IT can grow. And there are several limiting factors. This one is really tricky to tackle if you're trying to do things traditionally. Because as you were saying before, automation is great and automation has got you this far, but it cannot get past that point because the limiting factor then stops being the automation and becomes the security of the environment. How can you keep it secure? You can infinitely grow the servers on AWS. You could just need to click on that add server, and you can get as many as you want. But will they be secure? Will they receive timely updates? Will you be able to get actionable information from all of them? Will you be able to respond to threats on all of them? That's your hard limit.
You also have to consider silent failure, especially with your patching system. I mean, if you have 500 servers or however many, are you sure that, you know, any one of them didn't fail silently to get that patch? And that one server, I mean, imagine a load balancer where a threat actor only has to keep refreshing the page over and over again to hit the right server that isn't patched because it silently failed, and then they're in your system. So my challenge to our listeners that have really amazing automation systems is this. If you automate or audit it, can you find anything that's silently failing? If you don't, then you pass. But if you do find things that are silently failing, then it's proving my point. And I feel that, you know, a certain percentage of the audience will probably look at their automation system and find exactly that, something silently failing. And the more servers you have, the longer that auditing process is going to take you. So, you know, and it's exactly to your point.
And it's interesting because you will only spot this problem in your environment, actually, when you go over the limit. When your team comes back to you, okay, we haven't been able to finish the patching and we need to start over again because there's a new vulnerability or the cycle needs to be restarted or critical servers need updates again. And That moment right there, that's an eye-opener. It means that you just stepped over the amount of systems that you can actually manage. Throwing more people at the problem won't solve it. The time is still the same. Throwing more money won't solve it. You'll need a different approach to it. You'll actually need to change the processes. And in a field that likes new technology like IT does, it's really interesting to notice that people are very... they frown upon changing their processes. So changing the way things are done is harder than you think. Convincing people that the new way is better than the old is really tricky. That's even more than an IT problem. That's a people problem. But again, I digress. It's really difficult to explain how that gets important until you actually reach that point. But when you do, you're in a tight spot.
Yeah, you really are. And I think this kind of brings up a bigger conversation, maybe for another episode or part of an episode. I mean, we're hitting the limit of current IT processes, the way that they're currently being written, you know, the stereotypical processes, the boilerplate processes and things, you know, the things that we're all recommended to do. And I'm not saying any of those things are bad things to do, by far not. But I'm just raising the question, do we need a different paradigm, different ways of managing the system, you know, different styles, or do we need, you know, additional concepts on top of what we already have? And I'm not going to answer that question, obviously, but I think that's a question that we all need to ask. I mean, how effective is the, you know, default way we're dealing with these kinds of things? It's just not effective anymore. It's kind of effective, but not really.
Complexity is just growing out of hand. Things are getting too interconnected, too dependent on each other. And as soon as we add a new layer to try and solve the problem like automation does, we immediately increase the complexity on the next level to essentially make automation there unusable or no longer relevant. It's good at one level, but you go one level up, as soon as you move from systems to applications, you stop being able to automate as much because it's no longer the same challenges and you have more interconnections there. To your point, yeah, we're probably already knee deep into a new level where things just don't, doing the things that we used to do 20 years ago doesn't cut it anymore. The environment has changed enough that they are no longer relevant, but people are still insisting on continuing with the same things that they've always been taught and the same way that they've always done it. And it's just getting unmanageable.
Old habits, new threats.
Exactly.
Yep, just like our title of the podcast. So I think that's a pretty big topic. And I think I might try to bring this same topic up on the Home Lab show at some point, because while it's not as critical if it's not an enterprise situation, I still kind of feel like even some Home Lab people are creating more work for themselves and spending less time with their families as a result. But that's a story for another day. Is there anything else you wanted to cover as a part of this topic?
No, I think we've covered the big sticking points on this. Yeah, it's really something that you need to consider, if not just if your team is starved for resources or starved for staff, but actually if you're planning on growing your operations, if your business is deciding to expand, this is something that you need to consider. Are you still able to properly manage the systems that you have, or if you're the ones that you're planning to get to cover the new business needs? So keep an eye out on that.
I'm not going to promise anything, but if I can get the notes together at some point, I would like to kind of revisit this as what can we do about it? You know, we talk about auto scaling limits, budget limits, and all the things and some of the general things that can be done about it. Obviously, we don't know every solution in the world because, you know, we'd be on a yacht if we did. But, you know, what we will do is give you, you know, enterprise advice from people that were in the trenches and still are in the trenches. So maybe that's a topic we'll cover again. I'd like to.
Same. Thank you, everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. And until the next one.
Thank you.